everyone. Welcome back to Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. How was your long Memorial Day weekend? I know that extra Monday off was, well, exactly like every other Monday for the past 11 weeks, at home and inside. Although, the weather is finally starting to come around, which means people in Chicago, now more than ever, gathered at the still-closed parks and beaches. I know we all need that vitamin D, but let's keep a good 6-foot distance, and maybe follow the rules? Regardless of closed beaches and parks, I'm sure you socialized with someone this weekend. Maybe over a Zoom cookout or happy hour. Even though in-person barbecues are way better, we can all agree the internet makes socializing just a little bit easier right now. And what better to talk about with your friends than your favorite podcast? That's us, Obvi. We would absolutely love it this week if you shared the podcast with your friends and family. And hey, why not throw in a rating and review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it? We'd really appreciate it. Really, we would. Seriously. Speaking of Memorial Day weekend, this is usually the kickoff of summer vacation, which ties in perfectly to today's episode on K-12 education. We've got a stellar episode today. We're learning about the role of the federal government in education and how different types of schools operate. Then we'll poke fun at this week's headlines along with a special appearance, and we'll wrap up the interview with a Suffolk County High School English teacher, Stephanie Kostopoulos. And by the way, we're not learning about colleges or higher education today. Just your good old schoolhouse rock. For those of you wondering, Stephanie and I went to college together in New York, and when we were writing her intro, we had this whole conversation about whether to say a high school teacher on Long Island or in Long Island. And let's be real, it's on Long Island. I'm prepared to die on this hill. I could go on for hours about Long Island jargon, so to keep me from doing that, grab your margarita and let's get started. If you've become a regular listener of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, you'll know we always relate these episode topics back to the role of the federal government. And today, with education, is no exception. Yet, according to some, the federal government plays little to no role in education in America. According to the U.S. Department of Education website, education is primarily a state and local responsibility in the United States, which explains a lot when you look at states like Florida. It's up to states and local municipalities to establish schools and colleges, write curricula, and decide the requirements for enrollment and graduation. Private organizations can also create and execute these guidelines, i.e., why private schools exist. The idea of state-run education plays a major role into why education looks so different from state to state, and even county to county. I feel like I understand a little more why when I watch House Hunters, why the realtor is always like, "Yes, this home may have a little basement flooding, but it's in the best school district." It's all about location, location, location. When it comes to funding, the federal government contributes about 8% of the cost to run an effective school system. The rest of that funding comes from taxpayer dollars or private organizations and funds. The Education Department website even says that the federal government acts as an emergency response system, or fills in the gaps, as they say, when state and local municipalities need critical national support. I looked up what the federal government is doing now in terms of COVID-19, and it was a list of links to other websites named fact sheets. It's linked in the show notes if you want to peruse it. It's not necessarily a good or bad thing that the federal government plays a small role in education. Could you imagine what Trump would do if he could 100% mandate what children learn about and how they learn? You get my point. That being said, the federal government does have a huge voice in the civil rights of schools. There are three classifications of schools in the United States: public, private, and charter schools. America is all about the idea of choice, and that couldn't be more evident than in education. And the differences in those choices have to do with how schools receive funding. To get us started, public schools are funded by state and local taxpayer dollars with a tiny boost from the federal government. This means educational standards in terms of what is taught and how teachers teach are set by the state. State funding and taxpayer dollars also means public education is free of cost, and public schools are required to accept all students who wish to attend. And the exact school you go to depends on what district you live in. Conversely, private schools are funded by private organizations and funds, i.e., why they're called private schools. The funds also come from tuition costs and alumni associations. They don't have geographic restrictions about who can attend private schools. Basically, as long as you can get there, you can be a student. These schools can have religious values and usually require lengthy admissions processes. And because of the admission and tuition requirements, private school class sizes tend to be much smaller than, say, your neighborhood public school. And since these schools are privately funded, they do not necessarily have to follow state guidelines on education, although most notable private schools are accredited by some sort of outside organization. And then, somewhere in the middle, we get charter schools. Honestly, we could do a whole episode on charter schools and how they operate. Charter schools are where boats learn enough to successfully become charter boats. Jokes aside, charter schools receive government funding, but operate independently of the state school systems. Charter schools do not have to adhere to the rules and regulations of how to manage and operate their school. However, they are still required to follow regulations of the public school system, i.e. charter schools cannot charge tuition and must be publicly accountable. One of the interesting facts about charter schools is that they rely on families choosing to enroll their children in the school, and they must have a written performance contract with an authorized charter agency. There's also one other type of education in the U.S. that we haven't mentioned yet, and that would be homeschooling. But for today, we're sticking to your good old brick-and-mortar schools. Now, I don't know a ton about homeschooling, but I think that if I had been homeschooled, I wouldn't have trauma lasting into my 20s from mean girls and bullies. But I guess nowadays, every child is homeschooled in some sense. Thanks, Miss Rona! I bet you could guess it, but we're gonna have to dive into some history. Man, I always love the history moment. It's like understanding the rules of a board game. It sets the scene of how we got to where we are. Pretty neat, IMO. But first, let's look at the Constitution. There's actually no reference of education in the Constitution whatsoever, but the 10th and 14th Amendments have been wildly important in understanding the relationship between education and the feds. In a nutshell, the 10th Amendment says anything not outlined in the Constitution is up to the rights of the states, and the 14th Amendment demands that all states provide any person within its jurisdiction the equal protections of the laws. Just hold on to these ideas for the time being. So, before the 1800s, formal education was hard to come by as most children worked in trades or factories, and only the elite were taught skills past the alphabet. The playing field was most definitely not equal. Then enter Horace Mann, circa 1837. He's the newly elected secretary of the also new Massachusetts Board of Education. He brought a unique perspective to his novel role. He believed that political stability and social harmony depended on a strong education, and that public schools were essential to create good citizenship. That 100% makes sense to me. Anyone else out there? Mann also developed the idea of professionalized teaching in America. In totality, his goal was to create a system of secular, universal education in the United States. Then shit hit the fan with the American Civil War in the 1860s. I'm going to assume you all know the basics of the Civil War for this one. But long story short, the Civil War did not bode well for the education of all American children. Throughout Reconstruction, states were thrust into creating school systems for every child, including newly freed slaves. And we all know it wasn't fine and dandy for those newly freed people. During the end of the 19th century and throughout the 20th, racism and class warfare spiked with separate but equal and Jim Crow laws. This manifested into segregated school systems, and obviously schools for minorities were not equal to their white counterparts. All of this culminated with the famous Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education, in 1952. According to History.com, Oliver Brown filed a class action suit against the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, after his daughter, Linda Brown, was denied entrance to one of Topeka's white elementary schools. The case made its way to the Supreme Court after the district court in Kansas upheld the separate but equal doctrine. And famously, Thurgood Marshall, the head of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, acted as the chief attorney for Oliver and Linda Brown. The Supreme Court ruled the Kansas court decision to be unconstitutional. In 1954, Chief Justice Earl Warren opined that, in the field of public education, the doctrine separate but equal has no place, because segregated schools are inherently unequal. Because of this, the Supreme Court ruled that Linda Brown was deprived the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. Now, we all know racism in schools wasn't fixed by any means after this court case, but it shows how the federal government fostered social change for the betterment of education. Could you imagine what schools would look like today if this court case had a different ruling or hadn't happened at all? If all states acted independently of the federal government, education would look even more wild across the map than it already does. Florida would have sunk into the ocean from the weight of its own stupidity. And Brown versus Board of Education paved the way for social change in schools. But The thing about the federal government is there's a new man in charge every 4 years. And right now, we have an orange crayon in the Oval Office. He infamously appointed Betsy DeVos as the Secretary of Education in 2017. Honestly, in my opinion, this woman is a walking toothache. This show is all about being open-minded and learning about contrasting points of view, but I don't even know how to put DeVos's actions into a productive light. To start, she was barely confirmed as Secretary of Education when members of her own party voted against her appointment. It was so contentious that VP Mike Pence had to cast the deciding vote, which also was the first time ever in American history that the vice president had to make a deciding vote on a cabinet member. But hey, hindsight is 2020. Although 2020 had different plans for us. Where to start with DeVos? She supports rollbacks for protections of trans students, slashes public education funding, weakens protections against sexual harassment and assault. She attempted to strip teachers of their collective bargaining rights, and she wants to place guns in schools, just to name a few things. Also, her voucher system to use taxpayer dollars to allow students to attend private schools just confuses me. Maybe just use those taxpayer dollars to make the public schools better? I might be naive in that thought, but I honestly couldn't find an argument on that one. We've linked a timeline in the show notes so you can read more about her actions. In this case, I'm glad the federal government cannot fully say what goes on in the classroom from state to state. I imagine in Trump's perfect world, he would mobilize children to believe his word is law and to ignore skills like critical thinking, problem solving, and artistic expression, which his war against artists continues to baffle me because he would have probably gone bankrupt if Hollywood didn't save his career. So, why does education matter in this confusing society we live in? If we look at Horace Mann's philosophy that schools should exist to create good and upright citizens, education seems pretty important. This episode actually sparked a fascinating conversation amongst the Sit Still team about our own relationship with education and the power of knowledge. In our team alone, we have experiences in public, private, and charter schools. I personally attended private schools that were both religious and non-religious. Christina dropped out of school and then got her GED, and Mike went to school in Florida, which, lucky for him, didn't result in a meth addiction. But what's cool, too, is that he went to a charter school that specialized in film and television where he got to work on movie sets. If you put us on paper, our paths look wildly different. But I admire that about our team. We all bring a different perspective to our work. Throughout researching this episode, I realized education matters because it's all about creating a stronger tomorrow. Kind of like what we're trying to do with this podcast. Overall, education is important. In typical Sit Still fashion, we barely even scratched the surface on a clearly widespreading and complicated subject. But education is the springboard into both future subjects we plan to address and for combating the waves of misinformation and propaganda that is taking hold of what people have called the era of information. Knowledge is literally at our fingertips, and it's important to educate future voters not to educate themselves on subjects, but rather how to critically and independently digest raw information that they're receiving. We want to educate voters so that instead of sitting still and waiting for the world to change, they can get opinionated and get shit done. Stay tuned for our interview with high school English teacher and my stellar friend, Stephanie Kostopoulos, to hear her thoughts on why us young adults should care about the state of education. Misinformation being spread nowadays, we felt that it was important to address it. And we wanted to do that with a new segment we're calling the Misinformation Station. It seems like more and more children are prone to growing up believing these false ideologies. It reminds me of the 1940s, when a prominent children's author took to the pages to teach ethical, moral lessons to millions of children using silly, whimsical limericks. That man's name was Dr. Seuss. Unfortunately, Dr. Seuss is dead. And so is democracy. I'm kidding. Democracy's not dead yet, despite what Trump wants. But Dr. Seuss definitely is. Which means we couldn't get him to appear on the show. However, we were lucky enough to get Dr. Seuss's second cousin's brother-in-law, Dr. Excuse. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
I'm very glad to be here, Claire. Nothing could stop me from coming in today. In fact, it makes me think of one of my most treasured limericks. I have come to spread joy to the children of Earth. I have come to bring joy, jubilee, and much mirth. To feed their young minds, to cherish their worth, to describe in great detail the miracle of birth.
I'm sorry, did you say you were going to describe the process of giving birth in detail to children?
Yes. It is one of the very many seminars that I host in public libraries, schools, and child detainment centers. It's quite popular.
Okay. Well, I was hoping you could do maybe a couple of your poems about the dangers of misinformation.
Why, Claire, I would love to. Listen up, children. Come, listen. Come close. The news tells you lies, and those lies are quite gross. Wear a mask when outside, hide your mouth and your nose, because what's in the air is quite lethal a dose. But these are all lies. Now the truth I disclose. COVID-19 is a Democrat hoax.
That's not quite what I was expecting. You obviously didn't listen to our episodes on the coronavirus or the CARES Act. If all of this is a hoax, why are hospitals overrun?
I'm glad you asked. I have a limerick for that as well. And remember, kids, you can trust me. I'm a doctor. A doctor, I say. Yes, a doctor I am. Not these government agents running hospital scams. They take all your money and they take all your time, but yet did they mention that they're doing a crime? They poison your blood, shoot vaccines like ballistics, but vaccines, my good friends, will turn you autistics.
Nope, not true. Please stop saying stuff now. You're really missing the whole point of the show. I regret already so much of this.
To be honest, I don't quite know what your show is. Perhaps I can best explain with another limerick. Oh, the places I go are up to my agent. The paychecks I get have made me complacent. I go to most places, I'll go close, I'll go far. The places I've gone bought my wife a new car. And so I'll go anywhere. I'll go block after blocks to any news station, but my favorite is Fox.
That explains so much. I just realized I never asked what kind of doctor you are.
A doctor of mystical sciences, Claire. I specialize in crystals and essential oils.
Something tells me you probably prescribe hydroxychloroquine. You know what? Don't even answer that. I'm over this. Have a seat, doctor, if that's what you are. I did my own research, and it led me quite far. The stuff that I read has science to back it. The experts used facts to quiet the racket. Don't listen to all the politicians who've lied. Vote this November for those qualified.
Claire, I agree with you 100%. That's why I have some very persuasive YouTube videos I'd love for you to watch if you happen to have the time.
Hard pass. In fact, I think that's actually all the time we have for today. Dr. Excuse, I would say thank you for coming, but I kind of don't want to.
You know, I hear that exact phrase all the time. Thanks for having me.
And that's the Misinformation Station. Up next, this week's headlines. Joe Biden made news last week, as during an interview he said, "If you vote for Trump over me, then you ain't black," proving that in his old age, he is still flexible enough to stick his foot in his mouth. But seriously, Biden, you were Obama's VP. You already have major support from the black community. Your only strategy at this point should be to not insult them. In Minneapolis, George Floyd became yet another black man to be murdered at the hands of the police. Reports say he would have survived the encounter with the police had he simply been born white. In other racist news, justice was served when a woman was fired from her job for calling the police on a black man who was birdwatching. Luckily, the man videotaped the encounter as he recognized her squawking to be the call of the rare white-hooded Karen. This week, Nevada announced it will reopen casinos on June 4th. Officials say casinos will be exactly the same, but instead of risking all your money, your health will be the new gamble. My sources tell me casinos will also have new equipment. Instead of poker chips, guests will be given mini Purell bottles. And instead of slot machines, casino employees will sneeze on guests and then immediately walk away. It really will be the chance of a lifetime. An NPR article this week outlined the lives of classroom pets finding homes during COVID-19. My question here is, what did these animals do over summer break? Like, this isn't the first time schools were without students. I just figured a system would already be in place, right? But hey, I guess there should have been a lot of systems already in place. Anywho, if you're wondering, Chubby the Frog is happily living in a Brooklyn family home. We reached out for a statement on her new living space, but Chubby has no comment at this time. Trump threatened to shut down social media on Wednesday after Twitter factually labeled one of his tweets as misleading. This helped Trump maintain his superlative of number one hypocrite, as well as number one person who looks like the combination of both a hippo and a crate. Also this week, Trump demanded that state governors should allow houses of worship to reopen immediately. In a quote from NPR, the president said, "In America, we need more prayer, not less." I know Trump joined the thoughts and prayers train a long time ago, but I'm pretty sure America needs more COVID-19 testing, not less. And finally, last weekend, as the coronavirus death toll reached 100,000, Trump spent the day golfing. There's no joke here, just reminding you he still hasn't said anything to honor the 100,000 dead Americans. And that's this week's headlines. Up next, our interview with high school English teacher Stephanie Kostopoulos. All right, so for today's interview, we have Stephanie Kostopoulos. She is a high school English teacher in Suffolk County, New York, which, for those of us, is on Long Island, in my opinion, but that's a whole other thing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, welcome to the show. So to get us started a little bit, could you tell me about your background and how you got into education?
Sure. So I'm a lifelong learner. I mean, going to school from K to 12, to college, to grad school, school was my calling. I remember even before kindergarten, I would ask my mom to make me homework assignments. And so it was my destiny to end up in education. And so I'm a New York State certified teacher in English grades 7 through 12 and literacy grades 5 through 12. And this is my fourth year of teaching, although overall I'd say I have about 5 years of field experience. But like I said, a lifelong, you know, journey of education as a student and now as a teacher.
That's, yeah, ever since I've met you, you've always been really on the education train, and school was something that was always really important to the both of us. What's it been like now that you are the teacher and not necessarily the student? Is your role a little different? I mean, obviously you're a teacher, but...
Absolutely. I think our experience as students not so long ago is different for students of today. I mean, you and I have seen the evolution of technology in the classroom. We started off probably with a TV being rolled into the classroom every once in a while. Eventually, you know, a computer in the classroom, then a few computers to a smart board. And now the technology that's at their disposal is quite amazing. And it's incredible what they've learned to do with technology throughout their schooling. So I will say in that capacity, it's been different for me learning how to teach in a way that I was not taught. And that's not just with technology, it's also just with pedagogical practices. For example, like, you know, a current model of instruction is a student-centered classroom, meaning the teacher is the facilitator and the children or students, they're the ones that really, you know, do the learning and do the teaching. And it's not so much we don't teach them, it's that we give them the tools to learn and grow on their own. And so fostering independence is something that I think, you know, is something I'm trying to learn how to teach.
Mm-hmm. Have you come into any roadblocks with learning how to teach that, or is every day something new comes along?
I will say at first it was very challenging learning how to do that. You know, like I said, trying to teach in a way we weren't taught was very challenging at first, but I will say the more I practice this model, the better it becomes, and the more confidence I have in myself and also the kids. I think you know, when you start to place more emphasis on what the kids need and what the kids can do, you'd be surprised at what they can come up with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like if I walked into a classroom today, I wouldn't even recognize it. Like, I feel like, you know, I had the desks that you sit in and they're only right-handed and the teacher stands at the front. But even just from you sending me pictures, there's, you know, the triangle desks and things look a little different than they did.
Absolutely. Like you said, not just physically, you know, and instructionally, but look at my classroom. You've seen pictures, like you said, you know, different shapes of tables, round tables, and you almost don't feel like you're in a classroom. And that's what I think is cool about this new way of teaching that I think a lot of schools have adapted.
Mm-hmm. So obviously we are in COVID-19. This is a new experience for all of us in all walks of life. But especially in being a school teacher, classroom teacher, what have you had to learn how to do or experience something that your students are going through? Can you talk about your experience with that a little bit too?
Absolutely. I will say this is an experience I don't think any of us ever expected to go through. I will say that last day of school on March 13th was a day that marked the end of a world that we once knew. And I'm not trying to be negative or pessimistic here, but I think this really did cause changes that will, you know, be ingrained in our new society. I will say that first week or so being home, I was quite frightened. You know, what is our world going to look like? Not just with education, just in general. What is our world going to look like tomorrow? What's it going to look like a few days from now, a few years from now? And so I will say there was a huge learning curve, not just for students and teachers, but also for parents having to take learning into their own hands. And, you know, us realizing, I guess, the way our society was structured, you know, is not always permanent and it can change at any given moment. And I think learning to, I guess, be okay with change and not always expect things to happen the way you want them to happen. So I think that's been a huge change. And, you know, not going to a physical school building, but still having to create a space for children to learn. I think that at first was quite difficult.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your students have grasped these changes? Or do you think obviously every person is different, but do you think overall they took it on, or has it been a little bit of pushback?
I will say it does depend on the person. You are 100% right. Every week since we've been, you know, distance learning, I send out a survey for all of my students to complete, and I read their responses daily as they come in. And I will say at the beginning, a lot of students were overwhelmed and stressed because, you know, they had to pack a full school day into, you know, a day at home, which is usually not characterized by sitting for hours on end at the computer and, you know, not having a teacher there to explain things or not having classmates there to help you. And so I will say a lot of them were self-reporting how overwhelmed they were. But I will say there was a decent number of students who said they loved the changes that distance learning brought and said, you know, the pressures, I guess, of socialization or, you know, the pressures of school that are beyond academics were no longer there. And so for some students, that was a good thing. I will say as time has, you know, passed, I've gotten used to it. I think they've gotten used to it, that this is a new normal. But, you know, with any change comes patience, and we have to just, you know, accept where we are right now and try to make the best of it for the future.
Yeah, it really is a lesson in life that things can change on a dime. So something I really wanted to get your thoughts on. So the point of this podcast basically is to get people to understand big issues and internalize them and, you know, act on them. And in terms of education, I love learning and I am really excited about learning new things. But in the greater scheme, why does education matter in your mind? And why is it something that young people who maybe didn't care so much in school, why is education something that young adults who are maybe out of school should care about, in your point of view?
That's such a great question. And that's something I'm going to try to phrase in a way that, you know, make sense to other people as it makes sense in my head. I think education is an investment in our future. And whether you yourself had a positive school experience or not, whether you have kids or not, whether you prioritize education as an important institution in our society, I think it's important for us to note how education is not just about school. It's about the betterment of our society as a whole. You know, when economies and politics support schools and programs for kids, it really can stimulate local and global communities. You know, just providing kids with the opportunities to learn and grow, to learn lifelong skills, to learn how to be kind to other people. I think education provides a space for students to learn that and to navigate our world. And, you know, our world is ever changing. It's a global digital society that we live in. And so we need to teach students, you know, about this world. And we do that in a classroom. We do it, you know, over Google Classroom. It doesn't have to be a physical classroom, but I think, you know, education as an institution really does construct our future. And what do we want our world to look like when we hand it off to the next generation? And what do we want them to do with that world once they have it? That's why we need education, and that's why we all need to care about it.
Mm-hmm. That makes so much sense to me. I mean, personally, because I even enjoy learning, but it is an investment in our future. And in the same way that you invest in other elements of society, education is saying, you know, I want to make tomorrow better than it is today.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. This is such an interesting topic also, in the sense that school is not just one thing. It's not just one subject. And I see a lot of, in what I was reading about schools focusing on like science and math and those things, but you are an English teacher, as I know. So can you talk about how language also plays an important part in building that future and things like that?
Absolutely. And like you said, with different subjects, you know, I don't know about you, but there are some subjects that I took in high school that I don't really remember everything I learned in there. And as a lifelong learner, as someone who loves to learn and explore, although that sounds bad, I think it just goes to show you that that's not necessarily what education is for. It's not for us to know facts and figures. It's for us to use the skills we learned beyond academics to navigate our world. Like you were saying, with English and language, we live in a global society where communication is key. And it's not just verbal communication, it's written communication. And so I find it very important with language. How do we say what we want to say in a way that is effective and is clear and understandable? And that's what I try to emphasize with my students. I know it gets lost with literature sometimes. I think people focus too much on grammar or mechanics or, you know, how's the story structured? And it's beyond that. It's how can I communicate understanding to other people? And that's what I try to focus on with a 21st century English classroom.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that your students, do you see changes in the way they're communicating? Or is that more of like a overall experience?
Mm-hmm. I will say, you know, it depends what level they are, like, you know, what grade level they're at, you know, what popular social media channel is, you know, hot at the time. But I will say just throughout the year, you do see the growth in how they communicate. You know, just because students, let's say, you know, type a certain way or write a certain way, and a lot of times their texting language comes across in their essays, that's totally understandable. I think it's just being able to formulate thoughts and share them that is important. And I will say over the year, I do see them start to share more mm-hmm. and think more. And I think, you know, engaging in these social practices online at home really does aid the learning in an English classroom as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just because they talk one way with their friends, you know, that's not always the way they should write or should do anything, but you know, it might happen every now and then, right?
Right. And there are different modes of writing, right? You write to you know, write a recipe and share it with your neighbor. You write to text your friend. You write an email to your professor. There are different types of writing. You know, time and place, the context might differ. But I think what's important here is just communicating and taking initiative. And what I tell my students from day one is self-advocate. You know, if you have a problem or a question, you know, email me or come up to me and communicate these thoughts. And so I think communication here is key.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's even different from when I was in school. I mean, even just in college, I feel like some professors had a style where they were a little more hands-off, a little more, you know, not as involved. And sometimes I felt like maybe that professor and I maybe wouldn't have the best relationship. But that's cool that nowadays that you are trying to say, like, hey, like, you really have to speak up. You have to, like, advocate for yourself.
Absolutely. And I think, Claire, you know, we had a different experience growing up. Like I said, we saw the evolution of education technology. And, you know, when we left our K-12 lives, we really did see it, you know, start from the bottom and then reach such heights. And it's still continuing to grow. But I will say in high school, we just recently had an e-board where we had all the teachers' emails posted on the district website. But then again, there was no guarantee if I wrote my teacher an email, I would get a response, you know, by the time I wanted to finish the assignment. I think that was just characteristic of the world we lived in, because the world we live in now, as you know, is, you know, you get an email, you respond, you get a text, you respond. And I think, you know, there are so many modes of communication that I have with my students, but it's also the culture, right? You get a message and you write back. And I think allowing those pathways does make a difference. And I think it is different from what we experienced not so long ago.
Mm-hmm. And I think that comes into play a lot when I talk to my peers about how they view education now. People who don't have children that are school aged, they really feel like there's this disconnect. But yeah, there's so much that's happening now. If you could encapsulate one overall goal of your like teaching career, could you name something?
Wow.
That's kind of a big question. I know.
That's a big question, but I think it's a great one. And I think over time, my answer would hopefully change and evolve and be even better. But for now, I want students, first of all, when they come to school, when they come to my classroom, I want them to remember it as a safe, creative space where they were able to learn and grow and where they felt heard and respected. So that's first and foremost. Secondly, even if, you know, they aren't the biggest English fans or they don't really like to read or write, which a lot of my students don't, not to stereotype at all, but many of my high school students really don't go home and pick up a book or don't write for fun. And my hope is that in some way my class inspires them to do that. And if they, you know, see a poem one day and think of what they learned, or if they see a movie on TV and it was inspired on the book, I want them to pick up that book. And so just how can I, you know, reach my students and access, you know, their interest in learning so where they want to learn and be lifelong learners.
That's so beautiful. Lifelong learning is so important. And it's something you and I think we've always shared and talked about that too.
Absolutely.
Steph, this has been really, really great. And I have really learned so much. Do you have anything you'd like to share or anything like that?
I just want to thank you for making this podcast, not just with my episode, but with all the episodes you've done. I think, you know, the name says it itself, right? Sit Still, Look Opinionated. Sometimes we just need to sit back and listen and then form our own opinions. And I think you're providing a space for people to feel informed and, you know, really feel confident in different topics that they might not have heard of. And even in the questions you asked me, you really think about the viewer and, you know, how this topic can impact them. So I just want to thank you for bringing this idea to life, because I think it's wonderful.
Wow. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Of course.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
And that's today's show. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at sitstill_lookopinionated. And now on Twitter at sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, Christina Walter, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. See you next week when we learn about how to debate rather than argue. Enjoy some sunshine this week. Bye!